The following episode contains sensitive topic information that may not be appropriate for young listeners, as well as religious or other views that may not reflect those of the Sirens team.
Hello, hello, hello. Hey, Lindsay. Hey, Ryan.
How you doing?
Good. Hey, listeners out there listening or watching, we're excited about tonight's episode, but first we want to say it has been a long week and it's just Wednesday. Right? Whew. Yeah. I don't know if y'all feel like that, but I do.
I'm dead.
I'm brain dead.
It's the highlight of the week, though. We get to come in here and send some really good, interesting stuff later on to our listeners. Mm-hmm. We got a really good program. I'm excited.
That's right. And we're still growing on our socials. We've got like almost 330 Instagram followers now.
Really?
And yeah. Wow. And we've got about 208 Facebook followers, and our TikTok videos are doing good. And we're trying to stay active on our socials. So we are just loving that. And we're waiting for some stories, some spooky listener stories, hopefully. And Ryan was telling us before we got on to record that we've got some leads on some other podcast hosts that may want to come on our show. So that'll be a treat for us and for our listeners. We'll keep y'all posted on that. I do try on our socials to kind of let y'all know what's coming up or give you a little teaser or something like that. So tonight's episode. Okay. It's about each of us have picked a favorite scary movie, and we cannot wait to share with you. I'm so excited. And we want to hear from listeners too. We'll remind them at the end of the show. We want to hear what your favorite scary movie is and why. So comment on our socials or send us an email. We would love to hear your favorite horror flicks too. So with that said, Lindsay's going to go first and tell us about her favorite movie or scary movie and why.
Yeah. So I'm actually really excited because I don't know that a lot of people have heard of this movie or seen this movie before. And when I was in college, I worked at a movie theater. And it came out when I was working at the theater, and I would tear tickets and tell people which theater to go to. And I would always try to like sneak in while I was cleaning and watch the last little bit of the movie. But I never wanted to spoil it for myself. And I didn't understand it when I went in there, because it's one of those that if you are not following along and you kind of don't know the plot, you will have no idea what is going on. But the poster, like the movie poster itself, was so cool. One of the coolest movie posters I've seen in a long, long time. And I wanted so bad, because sometimes they would give us the movie posters after they went like out of theater. Mm-hmm. And I wanted that poster so bad, but I just never was able to get it because I was in school and I would only work on the weekends, so it would like go out during the week. But it was the coolest poster, and I'll show you guys some pictures and stuff in a few minutes. But so the movie is called As Above, So Below. Have you guys heard of this movie?
I've heard of it, and I actually watched it with you, I think, one time. Mm-hmm. Right. What year was it when it came out?
2014.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when it came out. So before I go into what the movie's about and why it's my favorite scary movie, I feel like we do kind of have to talk about the title a little bit, because it's this whole concept that flows throughout the movie. And so the concept of As Above, So Below was first seen in the Emerald Tablet. Now, the Emerald Tablet is a really, really old, like, cryptic hermetic text, okay? And this is highly regarded foundational text for many Islamic and European alchemists. And what do we know about alchemy? Most people, like mainstream, know that alchemy is centered around the Philosopher's Stone, the Sorcerer's Stone from Harry Potter. And alchemy is also associated with the artificial production of gold, so turning base metals into gold, right? Those are the two main things that most people know about alchemy, if nothing else. So medieval and early modern alchemists associated this tablet, this emerald tablet, with those two main things, as well as a lot of other things. But I figured that overall, most people would probably only know those two things. I know I'm not like an actual alchemist. I don't know like all the depths and details of everything that they do, but those are the two main things that I would recognize when hearing that word. So that concept was first kind of seen there in that ancient tablet. And this is real life. This isn't just in the movie. This is real life. And so the concept itself, according to scholars, it's understood as a reference to the effects of celestial mechanics upon terrestrial events. So everything above is connected to everything below. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I am not a scholar, okay? I'm not out here reading through all these texts, and it's not like I have a deep understanding of this, but I do think it's a really cool concept. And so a common interpretation of this is basically those structural similarities of the macrocosm, so the universe as a whole, mm-hmm. sometimes thinking of the universe even as a living being in and of itself, and the microcosm, which is the smaller world, like the earth here, humans, like many universes. And this is found in many philosophical systems worldwide, the most relevant one to this being like the Greeks. So now we get into some occultist interpretations, and y'all know me, I love a good occult moment. Okay. I think it's so interesting and fantastical. I just love it. So Helena Blavatsky, and I hope I said her name right, related the macrocosm microcosm that we just talked about to Pythagoreanism, the Kabbalah, and Buddhism. And I found this quote, and I just love this quote. And she said, in her interpretation, she said, "As the star glimmering at an immeasurable distance above our heads in the boundless immensity of the sky reflects itself in the smooth waters of a lake, so does the imagery of men of the antediluvian ages reflect itself in the periods we can embrace in a historical retrospect." So, and I know that's it can be a little confusing, but I like the concept because I think sometimes in different religions, you know, you have the heavens above and mm-hmm. God and the angels and everything holy, but there's kind of that disconnect between them and us. Mm-hmm. But I love this concept because it's kind of like the celestial bodies, the planets, the universe, everything above is connected to everything happening here on Earth. For example, like we have the moon up in space, up in the sky, but it has a direct effect on the tides of the waves, mm-hmm. on gravity. So everything's kind of interconnected. And I love the idea of us as humans being like born from the universe and like stardust. Like, I think the concept of us, you know, being born from stardust that maybe came from a completely different universe, like eons and eons away. And then life just recycles over and over and over again. And then here we are. And then mm-hmm. after we pass away, it's going to recycle over and over and over again. And our energy, our stardust is going to end up somewhere else. I just think it's so, I just love that interconnectedness of everything. Mm-hmm. So that being said, that's a big theme in this movie, is that as above, so below is tied to alchemy, is tied to the plot of this movie, the treasure that they're looking for. And there are a lot of references to Dante's Nine Circles of Hell, which I love the Divine Comedy. I think it's so interesting. We studied it at Emory when I was in my Italian arts class. And then we got to go over to Florence in Italy and see all of these things that inspired this story and all of these famous works of art, which I just loved. And so the movie was 2014. It was directed by John Eric Dottel and stars Perdita Weeks, Ben Feldman, Edwin Hodge, Francois Seville, Marion Lambert, and Ali Mahar. And I hope I said all of their names right, but it is a found footage documentary. And it explores the Paris catacombs. And this is 2014. So this is kind of when Paranormal Activity movies were really big. Mm-hmm. So first off, you have the Blair Witch Project, which was like the very first famous found footage scary movie. And then you have Paranormal Activity that kind of builds off of that found footage concept a little bit. But this movie, I think, is different in the fact that it, yes, is found footage. The majority of the movie is like documentary style shot. But there's also parts of the movie that aren't necessarily scary. There's parts that I don't think that you would have to be a horror fan to enjoy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Whereas Blair Witch Project, pretty spooky throughout. Paranormal Activity can be real spooky throughout. Yeah. But this one, it's not the scariest movie out there in the entire world. And I love a good scary movie, but I kind of like that about this one, that it's not insanely scary at every single point in the film. Not that it doesn't catch your attention, because it definitely does, at least mine, kept my attention throughout, because it has all these different themes and all these different exciting parts that kind of pull you into the movie. You never know what's going to happen next. And I just love it. So as far as the plot goes, I don't want to say too much about it, because if there's anybody out there that hasn't seen it, I don't want to spoil it, because when I watched it for the first time, I was just so enthralled by the fantastical themes. I mean, it's kind of like Paranormal Activity meets National Treasure, like how they go on this huge treasure hunt and there's all these different parts and there's all these different key players walking around in the catacombs. It's just a really fun time, so I don't want to ruin it for anybody. But overall, Scarlett is the main character, and she is researching and continuing her father, who is deceased, his research for the Philosopher's Stone. So that is the main plot. The main idea through this movie is that she's continuing on with his research. And right off the bat, at the very beginning of the movie, she's in this huge underground cavern. She's got this other guy with her that's filming her, and she's got this headlamp on. And it's so dusty, and there's this loudspeaker going on that's counting down to this demolition. And so she's crunched for time. She's trying to find this thing. You have no idea what she's trying to find yet. She's trying to find this thing. They're running all over the place, because if they don't find it in time, it's going to be destroyed. And this is a key piece of information for her to keep continuing on with the research, if that makes sense. So they finally find it, and it's this huge sculpture. It's like the Rose Key, so it has like hieroglyphs on it. I think it has ancient Greek text on it. It's kind of like the Rosetta Stone, a little bit, like the idea. So she's like, he leaves because his family's back in the house, and they went into this cavern through a tunnel in like the bottom of his house. So he's like, no, I got to get back to my family. Like, I can't be blown up in this demolition. I have a family to take care of. And she's like, no, go, go, go. I understand. So it's like counting down, and she's like going over the sculpture, trying to get it all on video so that she has like documentation, because she can't take it with her. It's this
huge, she can't carry it.
No, yeah. It's this huge stone sculpture. So she's like, I can't take this with me. I have to get as much of it as I can in the short amount of time. And then so she gets everything that she can. She's running back. She's trying to find the guy. These explosions start happening. So there's dust everywhere, and she's seeing these really weird things that should not be down there. And finally he calls out to her, and he gets her up in the house, and you're like, oh my God. So that's just the first part of the movie. So as soon as that happened, I was like, okay. I was like, I'm hooked. Let's go. I was like, I love this already. Because it just, right off the bat, it gets your heart like pounding, because I was like, oh my God, what's gonna happen? Is she gonna make it out? She has to make it out. She's a main character. But then what if this is like all a flashback and she just dies right here? Who knows? Yeah. But so that's the very first part of the movie. And then not to spoil anything else, but the rest of the movie, I mean, you have, there's Knights Templar in there. There's treasure hunts, there's cults maybe, there's murders, there's Dante references, there's hell and demons in there, there's dealing with trauma, and there's a ton of plot twists in there, because it's not just her. There are a lot of other different characters in this movie, and they all, when they go down into the catacombs, weird things start happening that are specific to each different person. And they kind of have to figure out, what is this? What's going on? Like, what do these things mean? Mm-hmm. So I don't want to give anything else away. I don't want to say anything else, but just know, like, I do, it's very, very highly recommended on my watch list. I can't say the same for the critics and everybody else, because it does only have 4.7 out of 10 on Rotten Tomatoes.
No way.
Yeah, for the most part, I think it was met with some kind of, like, it's very cliche, like, it's overdone, there's too much going on. But honestly, and maybe I'm just really easily entertained and just appreciate everything, but I think it was a fantastic movie. It's a unique take on found footage. It has these whimsical themes, these scary themes, everything's tied in together, and the acting is 10 out of 10. Like, I think everything about it is just, it's so different enough to draw you in and be entertaining at the same time. I'm not going to talk for too much longer, but I do have some fun facts about the movie that I found that I hadn't known any of these before I kind of refreshed my memory a little bit. So the first one that I found that I thought was so cool was that this production company had to get specific permission from the Parisian government to film in the catacombs. And it's the first movie to ever be filmed in off-limits parts of the catacombs.
Oh, really?
No other movies have been filmed down there. Now, they only filmed down there, I think, for a couple months. So obviously there are going to be some shots in the movie that were on a soundstage, like on a set.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it does feel very authentic in that it's underground. It's in the catacombs for sure. Even the crew didn't bring down a lot of lighting because it is the catacombs. So there's not a lot of electricity available down there. So most of the time when they were filming in the catacombs, they had the lights from the cameras. Not like all these fancy camera lights, but like the lights from the cameras and the headlamps that the actors had on. And that was it. That was literally it. Sorry, Brian just got home. So Jack's going to, don't let him scare you. Nothing scary is happening. So it did feel very authentic as far as the cameras and stuff went. Another fun fact that I thought was so funny was that while they were shooting in Paris, one of the only entrances to the catacombs where they were shooting, one of the main locations, was kind of through this hospital parking lot. So the actors would go, like, to the trailers. They would get, like, the blood and gore and dust and makeup on. And then they would go get coffees and just casually walk past these doctors and patients in the parking lot of this hospital to get to the catacombs where they were filming. So, you know, these people were probably like, do y'all need help?
Yeah, exactly. Casually drinking coffee. That was funny.
And so I just thought that was so funny. But also that because they were filming down there for like 2 months in like this June Paris summer season, when they would come back up from filming, they said that they eventually got to be where they were like mole people and like couldn't stand the sunlight because they spent so much time underground in that darkness, especially not having much lighting. I thought that was crazy because not only are you down there filming, but you also have to adjust every day going back and forth between above ground, underground, above ground, underground. That's crazy to me. This last one, honestly, I think is kind of shitty, but make up your own mind. Okay, so the director had some wardrobe tests underground just to see how everything was going to work together. And they had to make sure that the cast members, when they auditioned, didn't have like a lot of serious claustrophobia because it's underground. I mean, there's some tight spaces and it's dark and it can be very creepy. So as they're doing these wardrobe tests underground, the director saw this cast member was very, very uncomfortable. And so he actually wrote in some claustrophobia scenes for him, gave this specific character claustrophobia, just this one, just the one guy. So that when they filmed this scene, the director himself was like, Yeah, I don't think it was so much acting as it was real anxiety. And so the actor wasn't named, but I can tell you exactly what scene it is, which actor it is, because as you're watching it, and I remember even the first time I watched it, I was like, this guy's actually having a panic attack. Like, he's not playing around. Like, he is freaking out. And it comes across, like, it made, and I'm not claustrophobic, but it made me, like, want to freak out. I was like, I feel like I have to breathe so much because I feel like I just have to stretch out and walk around a little bit because he really is. Like, you can tell kind of that it's not acting because it's so believable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's, I don't know. It's just, it's a really good movie, and I just recommend anybody to watch it because why not? I think it's a really fun time. It does have some pretty scary parts to it, but it also has some really fun parts to it, too. So
and you get culture, too.
Yeah, and you get a little bit of art history, a little bit of culture in there. It's just, it's a fun time. I really like it a lot. That's why it's my favorite.
Well, awesome. I want to watch it again because it's been a while since I watched it with you. I do remember that one scene, though, with the guy. Yeah, it was intense.
Yeah.
I won't say anything.
That's good on the director's part, though. If you're really wanting realism, you know, you got to really put some people in. And there's been other movies, you know, that's done very similar things. But that's actually pretty smart. I'm surprised you got the guy to go along with it, though.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, that poor guy.
I got to talking and I didn't even show any pictures.
Okay, so here's.
I don't have a ton of pictures anyway because. All the pictures that I found, a lot of them kind of gave away some parts, so I didn't want to do too much, but this is the movie poster that I was talking about. So you have...
Yeah, that's cool.
It's as above, so below, so it's the Eiffel Tower, it's Paris, but everything's upside down, and there's a lot of skulls and stuff at the bottom for the catacombs, and I thought it was just graphically so interesting and very eye-catching with that bright red, too. I just love it. So I only have a couple other ones. There is one part that's really, really cool because as they go deeper and deeper and deeper down into the catacombs, at one point they're like, okay, this has to be impossible. Like, we cannot physically go any deeper down. We're already however many hundreds of feet down below the ground. There can't be any more. And then they go down this rope and they're going down this little space and there's a small, tiny little hole. And above it, in this picture, you can kind of see, but above it, I think it says it in a different language, maybe like hieroglyphics or something, but it says something like, and they'll be made to crawl on their bellies into the depths of hell or something, which I think is kind of a well-known quote. I'm not really sure where it's from, if it's from Dante's The Divine Comedy or if it's just from the Bible or what, but this is the moment where she's realizing, oh, so we might actually be crawling into hell right now. Cool. And just keeps going. just keeps going. She's like, you know, I got my little headlamp. Why not? I got to find this stone. We got to get out of here. So let's just keep on going deeper into the ground.
Why not?
And it's just, yeah, why not? It's just, it was really cool. And then here she is. And this is kind of where they're talking about the whole concept of as above, so below. You have the image and then the reverse image underneath, and it all ties into alchemy and finding the philosopher's stone and what that means, and it's just really interesting.
Very cool.
Yeah. Also, sorry if you can hear Champ chowing down on his bone in the background. He's doing his thing, so
that's okay.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so that's me.
That made me I do have one question though. Were any of the actors or actresses on anything else we might recognize?
I kind of recognize her.
I know. I feel
like I've seen her on anything else. This guy next to her, kind of with the blood coming down his face, also looks very familiar. I think that's Ben Feldman. I'm not sure what else he's been in, though, because I can never place him.
Okay. He is familiar. She looks familiar, too. Huh.
Yeah.
Well, cool.
That's like a really good movie. I'm not really claustrophobic, but going down in caves and small holes and not being able to turn around and just having to crawl until you get to the end.
Yeah.
It doesn't really sound too fun to me. And I've worked at coal mines and been in some pretty weird places, but that's just, yeah, it's not on my bucket list.
And it's like, so the movie as a whole, they're not, it doesn't always look like this. Mm-hmm. Like they, for the most part, are in bigger rooms, taller areas. Like there are some, I don't know if you guys heard this story, but, and I don't remember where I'd heard it, but there were like Parisian police down in the catacombs and they stumbled across this huge, like in real life, not in the movie, in real life. Mm-hmm. They stumbled across this huge room that was set up as a modern day movie theater. Like there were chairs built in there. There was a huge screen. They had streamed like strong electricity to power everything. And so you have to think to yourself, like, who has the resources, first of all, to get everything down here without nobody noticing? Because it was like an off limits part of the catacombs that was not on tour. So somebody had to go there and find the room, tell a group of people about it, because you know, not one single person, like you can't just get all of that down there as one person. It had to be a whole group of people. But also, who's getting the invites to go to these underground secret movie showings? And also, did they show this movie in that freaking cool would that have been to watch this movie in the catacombs? Are you kidding? I would have lost my mind. And so then, like, when the police went back to try to, I don't know, take photos or get evidence, all of the stuff was gone.
It was gone, and
There was just a note that was like, you'll never find us. And that's it.
Well, and I've heard... Are
you kidding me? That's so cool.
I've heard that for, like, teenagers and college kids, it's like a rite of passage almost to go down into the catacombs and party and not get caught. But you can get lost. They say it's very easy to get lost down there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There's all those, like, urban legends of people going down in the catacombs and then their camera battery dies and they're never seen again down there. And then there was some story that I heard that said there was this guy that went missing for like decades and they finally found him laying on the ground, obviously deceased, but he was like feet away from an exit.
Yeah.
But couldn't see it because he didn't have any light. He was just down there. Is that not awful?
That is, but I feel like if you were in Paris, you would go to the catacombs. Would you?
Yeah. Are you kidding me? Of course I would. I mean, they wouldn't let me in the off-limits parts, and I'm not cool enough to be invited to, like, a secret movie theater, but I would definitely go on, like, a tour, because I just...
Yeah.
I think it's so cool.
Would you, Ryan?
I'd go, but I don't know if I'd, like, be crawling through no, like, holes or anything. I'd want to see the big rooms. I'd be like, I want the big room right there. Keep that one. I'll kind of flashlight me looking in and say, yeah, that looks interesting.
One of the podcasts that I listened to did an episode about the catacombs and specifically about weird things that people had seen and heard. Like, they do give tours in parts of it. And people feeling like they had gotten pushed from behind when no one was behind them and hearing like disembodied voices and stuff. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of cool too. I want to give this movie another watch because now that I know more about it and I have the scoop, the inside scoop.
And there's a part in the movie that freaks me out so bad because they're walking through the catacombs and they come across this really old piano.
I remember that.
One of them, it's either her or him, starts playing this little tune. I think it's him. Starts playing this little tune and one of the keys sticks. And I just got chills when I was watching it because when we were kids, we had that old player piano in the house. And one of the keys stuck, and I swear it was the same key. And I was like, are you? I was like, there's no way. There's no way they knew I was going to be watching this movie. Are you kidding me? This cannot be real. And I love the movie.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. I was like, are you kidding me? Our piano did the same thing. I was like, no way.
Oh, my. That's good.
Where did you get the piano? Was it the same one?
No, where did we get that piano?
Someone gave us that piano. They had taken an old 1920 player piano and refurbished it to make it to where you could play it. But it looked like one of those old stand-up pianos in the saloons from the Wild West, because it had a, like a mirror right here and everything. Yeah. It did.
I swear that thing was haunted too. I swear I heard it play. I swear I did. But and then what did we do? We just left it on the curb when we moved.
No, Dad had to take it apart so that the Well, and it was so old at that point.
Yeah.
It was just it wouldn't keep stay in tune and But it was I didn't think about that being creepy.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, you'll always think about it now.
I will. But
okay.
Any more questions before we tackle my favorite? Favorite ever horror movie.
I love how we're all just so excited.
I got to put my glasses on though, so I can see my notes. Because
here we go.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Do you want me to wait, or do you want me to pull the pictures?
I want
up,
you to wait just a second, and I'll tell you.
Okay.
So my favorite movie is it's very well known, and I think it kind of was a little bit ahead of its time too. Because this movie came out in 1978. And when I say the name of the movie, everybody's going to know, you know, what it is and have their preconceived notions or remember, you know, how old they were when they first watched it and all this. I cannot remember actually how old I was the first time I watched this movie, but I think I was about 10 or 11. It came out in 1978 when I was 8 years old. So, you know, nobody's... Unless we were with Ryan and his mom went to rent the movie, you know, the scary movies for us. My parents didn't usually watch scary stuff. They weren't too into that. But anyway, at some point I watched the movie and I have been in love with it ever since. And the movie is Halloween, the OG 1978 one. Now I've watched all the other Halloween movies, including the three that just came out with Jamie Lee Curtis in the past few years. But this one is still my favorite. And as I was doing some research, I knew some of this stuff, but I did not know other parts of what I had found out. So you can bring up the slide. And I think the first slide is the actual movie poster. So when the movie came out, it's very plain compared to other movie posters. They didn't have a big budget for marketing this movie. And I'll tell you a little bit about that in a minute. But so the movie poster looked pretty plain, but it was very crucial, since they didn't have a lot of money to put into a poster, the font that they used and the image that they used. So I thought, you know, they were pretty smart because they wanted people to like wonder what, you know, just from the movie poster. So John Carpenter and his girlfriend at the time, her name was Deborah Hill, co-wrote the screenplay in 3 weeks. 3 weeks. He made sure too, which is props to John Carpenter, he made sure she got credit. She was the one that also cast Jamie Lee Curtis as Laurie Strode. And that started the beginning of a lifelong friendship between those two ladies. It says the movie was shot in 21 days in 1978. Now,
holy cow.
Yeah.
That's it.
3 weeks they had to shoot this movie. They were on such a low budget and they were so crunched for time to get the movie into the theaters by Halloween. So South Pasadena and Hollywood, California actually subbed for Haddonfield, Illinois, the fictional town that the movie is set in. And it was supposed to be October, right? Halloween. But when they filmed this, it was in March. So the producer, his name was Irwin, I guess I'm saying the last name right, Yablans, Yablans.
It sounds like goblins.
I know. He had a lot of challenges to work with, because if you've ever been to California, they don't really have seasons there, you know, and it's supposed to be fall in Illinois. So that's a lot different scenery. So he first wanted to name it the Babysitter Murders. Because he conceived it after he, you know, read the screenplay as, wow, this is a story about babysitters, you know, get murdered, whatever. So the inexpensive horror film had a lot of teen appeal, and that's what he was hoping to play to. But it features, and I'm sure everybody has heard of it if they haven't watched it, but, you know, all these events that happen in this movie happen in one single afternoon and night, okay? And so the producer said, the idea came to me that a movie about babysitters in Jeopardy could be interesting, because I reasoned that everyone had either been a babysitter, hired one, or at the very least had been a baby. So I thought that was a funny quote from him. But luckily, they did not name it the Babysitter Murders. They just decided to go with something simple that would keep baby. You know, it would, if they had named it the Babysitter Murders, that would have pretty much given the movie away.
Yeah.
So anyway, they went with Halloween. Now, Halloween was not a smash hit. Now, today, it's like a cult favorite. It's like, you know, film classes study this movie. But when it was first released in 1978, it slowly, very slowly, but surely built an audience and would eventually become one of the highest grossing independent films of all time. And that's another thing. It was an independent film. So, and that's one of the reasons why it had such a small budget. So after pulling in, now get this, and think about this. This is 1978. This movie pulled in $47 million.
Wow.
In the U.S. and an additional $23 million internationally, making the theatrical total $70 million from a $325,000 budget. That's all they had to work with. That's all they had to work with. Now you think paying the actors, getting the equipment, locations, travel to and from, and there weren't many special effects in the movie, which I think was brilliant. But anyway, it became the most successful independent film even throughout the 1990s, from a budget of a little over $300,000, like I said, over the 21-day shoot. Today, or not today, but in 2008, the earnings would have been equivalent to $150 million. So you can imagine what that would be. All right. So let's talk about, I don't know that anybody needs a summary, but I will give it as we go. I'll give a little bit more of the story, a little bit more. So I want to talk about the iconic mask that was used in the movie. And Lindsay, you can show us the next picture.
Here's the next
one? Yes. Okay. This is one of the funniest things I have ever read about a movie. So Tommy Lee Wallace was the name of the set designer, the production designer. And he was on a real tight budget. So after reading the screenplay, he knew he had to use whatever he had at his disposal, or he had to buy something real cheap. So he went to a costume store, and, you know, because it was March, so he had to go to and find a costume store in March. And he said there was a row of full face masks, like there was President Nixon and Dr. Spock masks and all. But Star Trek was real popular at the time. And at the very end of the shelf, he saw a Captain Kirk mask. And he bought a few of them for $2 each. So he took it and he's like, we got to do something with this, you know. So when he created the Michael Myers mask, he made two versions. The first one was like a Don Post Emmett Kelly smiling clown mask that they put frizzy red hair on. Thank God they didn't use that.
I thought that would be so similar to Pennywise from It.
Yes. You know? Or Bozo the Clown or something, you know, that was popular at the time. So they went with the second version. And what he did with this Dr. Captain Kirk mask was he took the sideburns off, and the eyebrows, and he cut the eyes bigger. Mm-hmm. And then he painted it like a ghostly white and darkened the hair. He did that with a few more of the masks to have extras. And so about four of these similar masks were used during the shoot. Okay. On the website movieweb.com, and if you'll go to the next slide, you can watch Wallace. Years later, he was showing how he did this. He shows in a 7-minute YouTube video how he created the mask. And it's really, I mean, it didn't take him hardly any time. So he goes through it step by step and shows you that. And he said he even remembered the paint he got from Ace Hardware was called Appliance White. And he said it took him about 30 minutes to make each mask. So in 2 hours, he had the four masks that they used for the movie. So I'll share the link on our socials in case any hardcore Halloween fans like me want to go watch it. It's really cool because he's talking with this guy while he's doing it and telling him like all kinds of little tidbits about the movie. Now, who wore the mask on the original movie? His name was Nick Castle. And Castle had met director John Carpenter while they were both studying cinema at USC. And so Carpenter had recruited Castle to play like a balloon-like alien in his debut film called Dark Star 4 years earlier, which nobody's ever heard of. And Castle made $25 a day playing Michael Myers. He was the one who donned the mask because John Carpenter liked his build, the way he was built, and the way he walked, his gait, okay, which was really important in the movie. Mm-hmm. So he made a total of $525 for playing Michael Myers. So show the next picture. This shows Nick Castle in the mask and then holding the mask on the set. So in comparison, Jamie Lee Curtis received $8,000 for her role as Laurie Strode. So he makes $525, she makes $8,000. But anyway, here's something.
Pick him a knife too.
Yeah, here's something interesting about Castle. He didn't have any intention of pursuing an acting career. Okay. He wanted to be a filmmaker and was an aspiring filmmaker. And so because John Carpenter knew him already and thought he would be perfect for wearing the mask, he talked him into it. And we all know that no matter how fast you run, Michael Myers always walks faster, right? Yeah, he was a tall guy too. You know, he was tall, so that was well, that was something. Now, the scariest scene for me, I thought he did a really good job in the movie. And by the way, he wasn't the only one who wore the mask in the movie. There were a few of the scenes where, you know, other people had to put the mask on at the last minute and do the scene or whatever. But the scariest scene for me, the one that's forever etched in my head, is when, you can go to the next picture. So she thinks, okay, he's been stalking her friends all night, killing her. She's babysitting these two kids and he gets into the house where they are and she gets the knife. He drops the knife and she gets it. And she thinks that she's killed him. He's fallen over. And so she sends the kids run to get help and she slumps down, you know, and leans against the door frame. And behind her, you see the body laying on the floor. And then all of a sudden, he sits straight up. And then he turns his head and looks at her. And that is, to me, that is so mortifying. I was just, like, so screaming. Funny. Like, he's awake. He's up. Get up. You know? But anyway, Castle was perfect for that because John Carpenter wanted him to make his moves kind of robotic, which he did. he did to perfection. So, and it added to the creep factor that he never ran when he was chasing someone. He just walked really fast with like a purpose, you know, with that knife he's walking. And interestingly, like I said, Castle didn't act much outside of the movie Halloween, but he did go on to have a successful career in Hollywood as a director and a screenwriter. And I did not know this. Some of the movies you might recognize. He directed The Last Starfighter in 1984, the family comedy Dennis the Menace in 1993, and one of our family's favorite movies, the Damon Wayans Major Payne.
No way!
Yes! So the next time you watch one of those movies, you can just think, hey, Michael Myers. Yeah. I know, that's right? So funny. So, like I said before, they had a tight budget. Most of the actors were virtually unknown, okay? The most seasoned actor that they hired was not Jamie Lee Curtis. It was the cast member who already had had a decades-long career when he took on the role of Dr. Sam Loomis. Okay, so go to the next picture. So, Donald Pleasance, the actor who played Dr. Loomis, he worked in film, television, and theater starting in the 1950s to the 1990s. And the producer decided on him. He was British. I didn't know that. But he decided on him because he had previously seen him play the bad guy in a Western called Will Penny, which I've never heard of. But anyway, for playing Dr. Loomis, do y'all want to guess how much he made? He was the highest paid
$30,000
person associated with the movie. You're close. $25,000. They really wanted him. And an interesting side note, as we're looking at this picture, you see him in character as Dr. Loomis, and then you see him in his older years in his regular street clothes. He died in 1995. Just a few months before he made his final appearance as Dr. Loomis in The Curse of Michael Myers that hit screens that same year. His mortified, unwaveringly serious performance in the first Halloween is what grounded the film, made it believable and credible, and gave it such tension. And his commitment to the series after that first movie, he was in a lot of the sequels, helped give future installments of Halloween a sense of legitimacy and weight. I loved him as Dr. Loomis. He made his dialogue so sincere and chilling, and the delivery was just spot on, I thought. He is the one who gives us a glimpse into this serial killer, Michael Myers, okay? And his psyche, you know? And so I'm going to read you, because I found a screenshot of this. This is my favorite lines of his in the whole movie. Okay, and he's telling, I believe it's the sheriff of the town or one of the policemen, he's telling him about why they need to be on guard. And also, if you didn't know, Michael Myers had escaped from a mental institution after being put away for stabbing his sister to death when he was a little boy. And so Dr. Loomis is the one that tells us what has happened since then. He says this: I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing left. No reason, no conscience, no understanding. Even the most rudimentary sense of life or death, good or evil, right or wrong. I met this 6-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes. The devil's eyes. I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up, for I realized what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil. Whoa. I absolutely love that dialogue, and he makes it so, I mean, the way he delivers it is just great.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, he's not playing around.
No, he wasn't playing around.
Evil. Lock him up.
And he had that sense of he had that sense of urgency about him when he came to the town after he realized that Michael Myers has, you know, escaped from the mental hospital. And he came to town. He was trying to get everybody, you know, to be like taking him serious and stuff. Yeah, and nobody was really taking it seriously, blah, blah, blah. And so I loved his performance. Now, now we go to Jamie Lee Curtis. Everybody knows Jamie Lee. She's our girl. We love her.
Next picture.
You can. Mm-hmm. Okay. I have loved Jamie Lee Curtis forever. Every movie she's in, everything that she's in, she just does, I mean, an amazing job.
She's so good.
She was 18 years old at the time, virtually unknown. And this character of Laurie Strode became her breakout character, her breakout role. She is the daughter of actor Tony Curtis and actress Janet Leigh that you see here in this picture beside her. And if listeners don't know, Janet Leigh was the original Scream Queen who starred in Psycho. And you hear everybody talk about the famous shower scene, right? And but she had acted in many other things as well, Janet Leigh. And Jamie Lee's father was pretty famous around the same time as an actor. So to play this up and to promo the movie, the producers and directors decided that they would use this picture, this side-by-side that you see on the screen of Janet Leigh screaming in the shower scene and then Jamie Lee Curtis screaming in one of the Halloween scenes. And so they played that up and it was brilliant. They sent it out. They decided to send it out and it made every newspaper in the country. Okay. Every newspaper in the country ran it. It was ingenious marketing and it didn't cost them anything, right?
Yeah, that's really smart.
So the actual violence in this movie is kept to minimum and leaves a lot to the imagination, which I like because I do not enjoy unnecessary violence in a horror movie. I like it when you see just enough to keep you like wondering and your imagination going instead of them like putting it all out there on the screen. So the approach that they took was this. They wanted a character-driven, compelling drama with all the right scares in all the right places. We had this idea we could orchestrate the scares and manipulate the audience. I cited the example of following a protagonist to the right side of the screen only to surprise viewers on the left side, which a lot of times that happens in this movie, which I thought was brilliant. They've got your attention over here and then something happens over here and you're like not expecting it. So do either of you know how many kills Michael Myers had in the original 1978 movie? Because you think about this, the last trilogy of these movies, how violent they were, which I didn't like that. I mean, some is necessary, but I mean, they just had him killing everybody. There was a lot of murders, but if you'll go to the next screen, Lindsay, 6 kills. That's all. And that was, I think one was the nurse, right, that came to town with Dr. Loomis. And then the rest were the friends, you know, one by one. Her friends were getting murdered that night. And I love that she did a good job, like, taking you into the mind of a babysitter on Halloween night, you know, and just the fun of it and all this stuff. And then the horror starts and it's just like you're right there with her and you're feeling everything that she's feeling. So what they did was they knew they didn't have a big budget. So they chose 3 theaters in Kansas City as the first locations to show the movie, okay, and to test it. They figured that area wouldn't attract too much attention and the advertising costs were a lot cheaper there. So listen to this. The first day, the movie made $200 in the theater. That's it. But the next night, double the people came. And the night after that, more people came. By the end of the first week, Halloween was the biggest thing in Kansas City. It was a phenomenal example of word of mouth marketing. So the film played until theaters had to, there was a Steven Spielberg movie coming out at Christmas called 1941. And so they pulled Halloween, even though it was the number one movie, theaters pulled it to show Steven Spielberg's flop, the movie 1991. And then,
yeah, I've never heard of that movie.
2 weeks after that movie was in the theater, people wanted Halloween back. So they pulled Steven Spielberg's movie and brought Halloween back to the theater, which I thought was neat. Okay, now, everybody who has seen the movie or not seen the movie probably has heard the iconic soundtrack, okay, for this movie. So let's talk about that because, you know, you think about watching a movie without the scary music and it's, I mean, what would it be? It wouldn't be nearly as scary.
Yeah, not half as scary.
So it's nearly impossible for me to imagine this movie as many times as I've seen it without the, you know, score and the soundtrack. And guess who wrote the music? Director John Carpenter himself. And it is just simply put, I think, as chilling and immortal as the character of Michael Myers himself. And this is what Carpenter wrote and performed. And he did that for many of his other movies. But he tells this story about what inspired him as he composed this music. And I want to read this short little tidbit to you because I thought it was interesting. He said, my father bought me a pair of bongo drums for Christmas when I was 13. And he taught me 5/4 time. Like most music is in 4/4, 2/4, or 3/4 time. But his father must have been a musician himself and taught him 5/4 time, like pop, pop, pop. So I thought that was clever, he said. And I sat down with the piano and just started playing dun, 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 like that over and over again. And I played it up an octave. And then I went back down an octave and just to see where it would come, you know, what would come of it. And he said, when I got the tune, I showed the movie. Now, listen to this. I showed the movie to an executive without the music, which was a big mistake. Don't ever show a movie to anybody unless it's completely done, he said. The executive told him, hold on. The executive said, that's not scary. And I'm not scared by anything like that. Okay. And then, you know, the movie came out with the music and it was scary then. So that was kind of cool little tidbit. Let's see, go to the next slide here. Oh, here's our Jamie Lee Curtis. Okay. So fun facts about the movie, which I got from, and many of these pictures, I tried to put where I pulled these from on the bottom of the screen. But a lot of the fun facts from here on out came from a website called ScreenRant.com. And if you've never visited that website, they got a little bit of everything. It's so cool. So Michael Myers was a real person's name. Okay, so Carpenter chose the name Michael Myers to pay homage to the owner of a small independent film distributing company in London called Miracle Pictures. It had first released it had released Carpenter's first film, and the name of his first film was called The Assault on Precinct 13. And they that company released it at the London Film Festival, and of course, Michael Myers was the person at the film company that was responsible for getting his first movie out. So he, you know, paid homage. So Jamie Lee Curtis, and here we go back to the budget. Jamie Lee Curtis and the other supporting actors, this fun fact, wore their own clothes because wardrobe didn't have money to spend on clothes for them. So all throughout the movie, they were in their own clothes. So you see her here, you know, with her button-up shirt that she was wearing that night and the blue jeans. And then earlier on in the movie, when it starts and they're walking home from school, you know, those clothes they had on and they were dressed for fall, colder weather, but they're filming this in like South Pasadena, California. And in one of the shots, you can actually see palm trees in the background. Yeah. So Since California, like we talked about, does not have seasons like fall, the prop team scrounged for pumpkins. They went and asked local kids to wear costumes, you know, because the little local kids were the extras on Halloween night. Those were
that
real
would
kids.
Be so cool to be able to say.
I know, right?
I was an extra. I was in that costume running around.
And this is what blows my mind. They used fake, painted, and recycled leaves that they scattered on the ground and the sidewalks before the outdoor scenes were filmed, then picked them up afterwards to use for the next outdoor scene.
Oh my gosh.
And get this, you are never going to believe this. I didn't know this till this week, okay? One young man who helped to create this fall aesthetic on the set was named Robert Englund. You know who he is, right? Who later became famous as Freddy Krueger in the Nightmare on Elm Street.
No way!
Yes. So show the next picture and you will see what I mean about the leaves. Okay. You see, they painted like in the picture on the left where that iconic scene where she feels like somebody's watching her.
Look at him just standing there.
And he stepped out from behind the bushes. They took spray paint and spray painted the bushes to make them look like they had kind of a fall-like
that's
color.
So funny.
And the leaves that you see there and in the picture over here where she's carrying the pumpkin, those are all fake. And the budget was so tight that they had to pick up every one of them and bag them back up. Yeah. I know, right? But it was so cool to me that Robert Englund was one of the prop people on the set. Yeah. And this is another fun fact. I told you in one scene you can see palm trees in the background, but every car in the movie has California license plates. And they don't even try to hide it.
Honestly, they're probably like, you know what? We don't have the budget for that.
We don't have the budget for that.
About it.
Well, we don't have the time for it. I mean, you know? Yeah. So
it'd be cool if it's the same tag. Every time you see a car, it was just changing one tag to each car. Nobody would probably even notice.
I know, right? Because the iconic car in the movie is the one that Michael Myers stole, and he's driving that old ugly station wagon-like thing. But anyway, I saw a meme that said, who taught Michael Myers how to drive?
Like, I literally was just wondering that. Like, how does he know how to drive?
Yeah.
He was in this when he was six. He's not in there learning how to drive. Right. He's not doing that.
Right.
He's
so
TV in the crazy house.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the Myers house that, I mean, when you think about the movie, you think about a lot of things, but the house usually comes to mind, you know, the creepy house. Well, that house was actually an abandoned building that was owned by a church in South Pasadena. The film crew had to put up, now get this. This is probably what they spent most of their money on. The film crew had to put up wallpaper in certain places, furnish the home in certain places, install electricity and water to make it look like a real lived-in home during the movie's first scenes.
That's the whole budget right there.
Yeah, the movie's first scenes, okay, you're seeing through this little boy's eyes. You don't know who it is. You just know you're seeing through these eyes, and they come into the house and get the knife and go upstairs and into a bedroom, and the sister's killed. So, you know, they had to make it look lived in. So they did that, and they filmed the first scenes of the movie, and then they gutted the house and made it again look like the old abandoned house it was for the rest of the movie. And pull the picture up, Lindsay. So you see in this little inset picture, they've got electricity. If you look back at the house, they had to like dress up the front of it a little bit. The door is different. You know, blah, blah, blah. And then if you look over here, you can see a light on. And when they go to the house to look for Michael Myers, Dr. Loomis and the police go there, they realize that someone, you know, has been there, but there's no electricity. And when they show it, it really does look like a really old house. Wallpaper is like ripped and the floors are dirty and the stairs look old and all that stuff. So that's probably where most of their budget went. So a few others on the set stepped in for Nick Castle to wear the mask, like I had told you earlier. And there's a part in the movie where Lori, she grabs the mask and she jerks it off of Michael's face. And the face you see is not Nick Castle. It was a stand-in actor named Tony Moran. And you just see his face for a brief, you know, minute. But you don't know it's not the same actor because you've never seen Nick Castle out of the mask, you know, but whatever. And so that was a fun fact. Originally, now get this. This is blowing my mind too. The writers considered asking the Lord of the Rings actor who played Sauron. And he was also in Star Wars films. His name was Christopher Lee. And they had originally thought about asking him to play the part of Dr. Loomis. Can you imagine how different that would have been?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like that.
It would have been crazy.
Okay, another fun fact. When Lori and Annie are babysitting, Lori's at one house, Annie's across the street at the other house. And they're babysitting the kids. And if you notice on the TV, there are horror flicks playing on the TV. One of them is The Thing from Another World, which was actually a horror movie back then. And the other one was Forbidden Planet or something like that, which was actually a horror movie then. So John Carpenter and the producer wanted to give props, you know, to their fellow, I guess, horror movie directors. But y'all got any questions? I just thought that I knew some of this stuff, but I didn't know. There was a lot of stuff I didn't know. But the reason that I think my biggest reason is for this being my favorite scary movie is because they didn't have CGI. They had no special effects, really, you know, except some fake blood and, you know, it's just amazing to me that they set that tone for terror with these few basically unknown actors and a budget that was not really enough to work with. And that's
crazy.
21 days they shot this movie, and they had no idea that it would become as popular as it is. It really is a cult classic to this day. Because the way they directed it wasn't like over the top cheesy or anything. Like a lot of the movies you see from back in that day were really cheesy. And they would show like the creature from the Blue Lagoon, you know, and then it would ruin it for you because you could tell it was like a fake.
So fake.
But this movie didn't really do that. And you know, it was so consistent. And it just, I don't know, it just still to this day is one of my favorites. And I get scared every time I watch it. I do. Like, I know my favorite moments are coming up or the scary moments are coming up, but I'm still yelling at the TV, run, girl, run, you know, whatever. But Michael Myers has terrified me. If anybody would ask me, who's the scariest movie horror villain ever? You know, it wouldn't be Dracula. It wouldn't be Freddy Krueger. It wouldn't be Jason. It wouldn't be an alien. It would be Michael Myers because, you know, he had like superhuman strength and he never spoke a word.
And he never dies. Like he will not die.
Yes, he won't die.
Invincible.
Yes. The end of the movie. Oh, yeah. I hope everybody's seen this movie because I'm just going to ruin it.
Skip ahead 30 seconds if you haven't.
Yeah, skip ahead 30 seconds if you haven't seen. But at the end of the movie, you know, when it shows that shot from above of him lying on the ground after he falls out the window, the two-story window there in our picture, and he's just laying there, you know, and then Dr. Loomis turns around to talk to her, and then they go back to the window, or he goes back to the window, because he shot him, right? He shot him with a gun. And he falls out the window and he's just laying there. And then they go back to the window and he's not there. And the music starts playing. I'm like, oh, dear. Here we go.
So, okay, but so here's my question on that. So he never runs in the movie.
Right.
So how does he leave that quickly? Or does he just run when people are looking at him? Just like run to his ass. You know
maybe
what I mean?
He just, yeah. Maybe he just.
Like, nobody speed walking out of the shot that fast after they got shot. So I feel like he's just running when nobody's looking.
When nobody's looking, yeah.
Yeah.
He just books it.
Yeah, it just has such a creepy little weird run.
Well, you're forgetting he can drive a car.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, like I said, he just goes and jumps in his car, parks it down the block. He's like, oh, they think I'm still walking.
Yeah, because the car was still there somewhere. Yeah,
he's drifting around the corners.
Oh, it was, and you know, like even the simplest scene that they set up where she's looking out her window and she's seeing the clothes on the clothesline, the sheets blowing in the breeze, and then he's standing there. I know there's been a lot of memes about that, and some of those are great, but just it's like you would never think, how could that be scary, you know?
Yeah.
And a Captain Kirk mask?
What? Yeah. Like, it's almost so wild and funny. There's no way it could be scary. But then you watch the movie and it's like, oh, shit. Like,
yeah, really. Scary. And here's something else. Serial killers, you know, the news, TV and all were just, you know, had become, you know, pretty commonplace. Serial killers were getting a lot of, really a lot of press. You know, it was in the 70s that Charles Manson and his bunch and, you know, so here's a movie that for, you know, most people, it's something that could really happen, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't like some sci-fi alien creature or something like that. It was something that could really happen.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's what's at the heart of it is your imagining, because I babysat a lot. Lindsay, I know you did too. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you know, sometimes when I babysat, there wasn't nobody hardly around, you know. Mm-hmm. And what would I have done in this situation? You know, and the teens were like so believable, although none of them, they weren't, some of them weren't even teenagers at the time, but
yeah,
they were so believable. And it was kind of like, if you were a teenager watching it, you're kind of like, yeah, you know, you had that vibe and all that stuff. But anyway,
it just has more of like a real life. This is like somebody's life. This could actually happen. Cause I feel like a lot of the older horror movies, like around that time, were so over the top and like completely out of this world monsters, like Lagoon, Dracula. Yeah. I mean, serial killers, I feel like the term serial killer had just really been coined around this time. So it's scarier because it's not over the top. Like, this could happen in real life, you know?
Right. And, you know, it still stands up to the test of time because it's still, to me, the most believable one out of all the sequels. And even I watched all of them and I watched the trilogy, you know. Actually, Lindsay and I were in Savannah, Ryan, and we went to the house where they filmed, like, Jamie Lee Curtis's house in these last movies, and got to go there.
Oh, my God, that last one.
I know. And I was like,
Homeboy ain't coming back now.
No, if he comes back from that, I don't,
no possible way.
But I still didn't enjoy those last three as much as I enjoyed the first one. I don't know what it is about it. It's just the most believable, stands up to the test of time, you know.
So, and I can understand like a franchise of like, this was so popular, we have to make more. Like, I can understand that. But I kind of feel like the whole franchise is just all over the place.
Yeah.
Like,
that was the problem, different directors, different,
and they made all these movies, and then they circled back and like, oh, here's what would have happened if
all these other movies hadn't happened.
That's what I don't like.
I mean, they're scary, don't get me wrong.
Yeah, they're scary,
and
but
Halloween H2O, Jamie Lee Curtis came back for that. That was pretty scary. That was kind of freaky. It didn't have a lot of over-the-top stuff. But, it was just, it's been really a really weird, it's had a weird run for sure, but this one will remain my favorite. I won't bore y'all with all the, you know, other things I could say about it. Although I do have Michael Myers earrings, and I can't believe I didn't put them on. I've got my Batman earrings on.
Where's the earrings?
I know.
How could you?
I really like, I like how it sets bases because I'm into psychological thrillers and things like this. Imagine how cool it would be to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist and be able to talk to these different types of people, whether, you know, there's something like Michael Myers or they have like spirits attached or whatever. just to be able to talk to people. I mean, I know you're not really supposed to tell people about it. I mean, you could probably say, hey, you know, can't say anything, but I've talked to some crazy people like this, that, or the other. But it'd be really cool to be able to. And I think that sets a standard for some future movies, because there's a lot of movies that come out after this that was more psychological and that actually had those psychiatrists based in the series, in the, like the substance of the movies. And also, as you was talking about Michael Myers raising up, you know, I'm not only horror, but, you know, I like watching wrestling and stuff. The Undertaker, that's one of his famous movies. He's in the ring and he kind of slowly lifts up and he's like, and that's, it's iconic. So when you said that, I'm like, that's where he got it.
You know? I didn't think about that either.
So and it just hit me. And I think weird stuff anyways. But like I said, I kind of like connect things. But there's a lot of movies that kind of, I mean, it may not have specifically been based off of this, but a lot of these I can see in future movies that will come out after this, which I think is really cool. And like you said, it could really happen, because it's a guy in a mask. Going around terrorizing people, and it can happen in any neighborhood, anywhere across the country or the world.
And I don't know about y'all, but like somehow I dress up every Halloween, you know, I'm just kind of into it. But when you go out on Halloween and you see somebody in a mask dressed up like Michael Myers carrying around a knife with their little navy blue, you know, suit on, I don't get too close to them, because I think, you know, what if some psycho really is out here wandering around, you know, just dressed up like Michael Myers, nobody can tell who they are, and they're just like wreaking havoc. So I don't get too close to them, you know, I'm just like, oh. But Ryan, you said psychological thrillers, and that made me think, I got to give props. I'm only going to give a mention to this movie, but this is one of my favorites. It's a movie called The Others, and it has Nicole Kidman in it. And I'm telling you what, that is a creepy movie. There's creepy kids in this movie, and I just can't even, you got to watch it. I liked The Sixth Sense, but I think I like The Others as a psychological horror movie. You know, it was just, it was really good. There wasn't, was there any killing in that at all? I mean, I don't think there was, but what happens in the movie is just freaky.
Such a
so I look it up, watch it. Listeners, it's worth a watch.
That one's definitely in my top five horror movies too. And I love Crimson Peak. Have y'all seen Crimson Peak?
Yes. Oh, yes.
I love that one too.
Oh, that's a good one. So well, good. We have talked and talked, the ladies have, so we are going to let Ryan wrap it up with his favorite horror movie, which I have not seen.
Me either.
So I am looking forward to hearing about this. Ryan, take it away.
Right, and there's a lot of mainstream movies, you know, that I could have went with, you know, you see Exorcist, you know, you got the Halloween, the Freddy Krueger's, Michael Myers, all that, Jason. I really like those, but I wanted to talk to something a little different, and something that's among my favorite that I think was ahead of its time, that is probably not as commonly known, but to me should be at the top of anybody's list. In its own particular category, not like psychological or psychic or anything like that. But there was a movie in 1988 called Pumpkinhead, right? It was actually inspired by a poem written by Ed Justin. It just so happened that the Laurentis Entertainment Group sent Stan Winston the script only, and it expected him just to do the special effects on this. But Winston, being an opportunist, saw the project as an opportunity to make a directorial debut, and kind of like Sylvester Stallone, he's like, I'll do this, but I'm, you know, I'm going to be the head guy. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, he, even though he wasn't really in the movie, he said, no, I'm directing the whole thing. And so I think that's really cool. And some people say, hey, and the reason why I like it so much, because there's always folklore, you know, you hear about such and such could be a witch or a warlock, or they, you know, I'm going to cast a curse on you because you done me dirty, or, you know, you did this or that. I'm going to curse you, you know, and with that comes, you know, whenever you curse something, you know, when they say, and I've seen other things, you know, with magic comes a price, you know, that when you do something, something will come back on you, things like that. So in every generation, every kind of lifestyle, there's always been something like that growing up, right? Especially way back in the woods, you know, whether you live in the swamps or the mountains or whatever, there's always that one person. you know, that deals with that mojo, you know, whether it be good or bad or witch doctors or whatever. And so I went with Pumpkinhead, and I'll go ahead and tell you the poem that was created that actually inspired the movie. Okay. So it says, keep away from Pumpkinhead unless you're tired of living. His enemies are mostly dead. He's mean and unforgiving. Laugh at him and you're undone, but in some dreadful fashion. Vengeance he considers fun and plans it with a passion. Time will not erase or blot a plot that he has brewing. It's when you think that he's forgot, he'll conjure your undoing. Bolted doors and windows barred, guard dogs prowling in the yard, won't protect you in your bed. Nothing will from Pumpkinhead.
Oh, that's crazy.
That's so and good.
That is awesome, right? So yeah. When I saw this, like you, I got chills. I'm like, oh my God. You know, I can totally see somebody reading that and like, we need to make a movie, right?
Movie.
What they did with this movie and like how they created the character and the Pumpkinhead out of this, I thought was ingenious. To go from a poem to what I'm about to show and tell you is light years ahead of its time, and the guy should like, you know, win major awards for this. And it's based on, like I said, Pumpkin 1988. As a child, the head star, Ed Harley, witnesses a man to be killed by a monster. Okay. In the present day, Harley's son, Billy, is killed by a group of teenagers. Ed then contacts a witch named Haggis, first asking for the resurrection of Billy and then for revenge against the teens. So he goes back in these, I mean, and it's really cryptic. I mean, it's like some serious voodoo stuff, right? And it's and the star who plays Ed Harley is very popular. His name is Lance Henriksen. And he actually starred in the Aliens movie in 1986 with Sigourney Weaver. He also played in the Aliens 3 movie that came out in 92. He was in Hard Target with Jean-Claude Van Damme. Terminator with, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Yeah. He played in The Quick and Dead, The Quick and the Dead in 1995. And in Tarzan, he was the voice of Kerchak. Okay. So he's a very popular, well-known actor, and he does a really good job in this movie. So, like I said, it really excites me, and I kind of gave it the plot away, but I'm going to pull up some pictures here. So it's basically Ed and his son, Billy, right there. That starts out the scene, and it shows he's a single father. He's got a son, and he's cute as a button. I mean, how can you not like this kid?
So cute. Yeah.
Right? So he's out there, and Billy, who's his son, is his entire world, right? And he's trying to raise him right, you know, and he's a little strict. Hey, you need to do this, don't go out too far, go out and play. And they live way out in the country, okay? So he does this, and while he's working and he has a little store, he lets his son go out and play, and his son wanders off a little bit and he's playing in the field, okay? Mm-hmm. So what is unknown is there's some teenagers, right? And they come in and they're riding dirt bikes. Okay, so they've got motorcycles and stuff. So we can go ahead and pull that up. So, and they pull up, and there was a very tragic accident, right? One of them does not see Billy. He jumps the hill. On the other side of the hill is Billy, and he kind of hits him. And unfortunately, Billy does not survive. Okay. So there comes, you know, now Ed. You know, he's actually enraged. He's very distraught. He just lost, his son, which is his whole world. And you can see here in the next picture, you know, it really affects him. And he's not in his right state of mind, which you can understand. He just lost his very young son, which was everything. So then, like I said, he remembers. He starts remembering about a tale that he heard growing up. Hey, there's things you can do if somebody wrongs you to make that wrong right, to get even with them. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then he goes to this witch named Haggis, and you can show the next screen, and you can kind of understand that she lives out in the swamp.
She's freaky.
Very bad. And I said, this is way, way deep in the swamp. I mean, the scene where he goes to get to her will creep you out, right? Mm-hmm. She's way back in there. And it's some serious voodoo mojo stuff, right?
Let's
and
go.
Then, you know, and then the spell and the curse requires a lot of different things, which I'm really not going to get into, but you do have to dig graves and a lot of different, it's a blood spell, so there's some things involved. So you can show the next screen here, and it does involve his son, which makes it worse. Yeah. Which makes it worse, right? And then,
that's a little boy from the beginning?
Huh?
That's a little boy from the beginning?
No, that's not. That is actually...
Okay.
What is... Damn. No, that is not the little boy, but that is part of the curse, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Because Pumpkinhead, like I said, is a humanoid demon that tracks whatever it is called upon to track and is virtually unstoppable, right? So, once this thing is cast out and the spell is cast, it is set on a mission. And like the poem said, once it's directed at you, it doesn't matter what's going on. It's coming for you, right? Mm-hmm. So, it catches up with one of the teenagers that has actually wronged, and it was an accident, but he did end up, you know, that was involved in the accident with young Billy. And you can see here in the next screen that Pumpkinhead has found this person. Mm. And Pumpkinhead does like to, I think it gets a kick out of tormenting and terrorizing people, because it's like, I'm here. There is absolutely nothing you can do about it. So now I'm going to have my fun with you.
Hey, can I ask you a question? In the last picture with what she was carrying, was that part of what they had to have for the curse?
Yes.
Is that a dead body?
Yes.
Ooh, okay.
You know what it reminds me of?
What's that?
It reminds me of Lord Voldemort. You remember in the last movie when he's like curled up?
Yeah. Well, like, it's creepy. Though. Oh, okay.
So... Go ahead. And like I said, the movie is like, it builds really good. And I really like the way it sets every scene up, you know, and the suspense is killing you. You're like, when's it going to show up?
Ooh.
You know, and they're trying everything. And it's just like in the poem. I mean, they're barricading themselves. They're going different places. They're trying different things. And it's just like, okay, is it going to work? Where is he going to be at? When will he show up? How will he show up? But like I said, this thing like has a beacon, a tracker device. It knows where you're at, right? Because it's unworldly. And like I was saying, when you cast curses, you know, they don't play by the same rules we do. They know things, right? They play on a different realm. So, and we've all know, and I believe in curses, and some of these things are true. And these are based off actual folklore from things, you know, in the past. So something like this may or may not have happened to be based off the poem or the movie. It may not be exactly this way, but something similar had to have happened to for this to be created, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people disappear all the time without a trace, so who knows, Pumpkinhead, good or whatever. So, like I said, the next screen here, you can pull up. This is Mr. Pumpkinhead.
Oh, look at those teeth.
I don't like him.
Like I said, he will look you dead in the eye. Like I said, he comes in there, and when he knows you, he looks at you like you're mine now.
He looks like he's having a good time, too.
That's what?
He loves his job.
Oh, he loves the job.
That he's got one job, and he's very, very good at it.
Mm-hmm. PhD.
So, like I said, and as the more the movie goes on, the more Ed Harley realizes, and the more he's affected by this, right? Because he knows what he's done, and he has to see the after effects, because at one point in the movie, him and the teenagers are together. Right? Mm-hmm. So you can pull the next one up. The more things start happening, the more he is affected by this, which again is part of the curse. Right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not really going to give anything else in the movie away as far as what happens at the end. It's kind of a plot twist, right? And it's really exciting and terrifying, to be honest. But it's part of the curse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to leave you with this. If you wrong somebody, whether it be purposely or, you know, especially I hope you don't do it purposely. And if it comes to the point that it affects somebody, that it shatters them to their soul, or maybe it's just that person is just crushed, right? If that person is so shattered and they know somebody, you may be able to open your eyes and come face to face with Pumpkinhead. View the next one up, and hopefully nobody wakes up and sees this coming at them.
Oh, gosh. Holy cow. Now, so, that's legit scary. That doesn't look cheesy or I mean, that's some good costuming right there.
And what year is this movie?
That movie came out in 1988, and a gentleman by the name of Tom Woodruff Jr. actually played the character of Pumpkinhead.
There's somebody in that?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And like I said, you know, curses are real. You never know. So be nice and treat people good. You never know. You know, you might be like, oh, I don't care about them, but then they make a phone call or go deep in the woods and talk to some witch doctor and... And then you wake up in the middle of the night and look at that. So be careful.
I don't care about them.
God, be nice to everybody is all I got to say.
Yeah, good advice. Good advice. Oh, my gosh. I cannot wait to see what our listeners think about these movies. And I'm going to watch this weekend. I'm going to let you know what I think about it.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to see your feedback.
Yeah. I got to watch this movie.
Yeah, me too. Me too, definitely. I might watch all three movies this weekend. Just binge scary movies. I usually have on Friday nights is usually my scary movie night where I stay up late. And, you know, my husband doesn't, Lindsay's dad, he's not into scary movies. So
That's probably why a lot of people didn't visit us younger, because you're not going over to Ryan's house. They watch scary movies and they do crazy stuff.
Yeah, they watch scary movies all night. Those dummies.
Yeah, they would rent, they would go like, and this is back when VHS was big, and my cousins and things like that, some have passed away. Every weekend, you know, they would go rent as many scary movies as possible, and they would have, every weekend, it was just like a horror fest.
Yeah. From,
you know, and it was just crazy. And here we are, most of us were like kids, and we're like terrified.
Exactly. I was probably... I don't know, five, six, seven when we start, you know.
I had a funny story. I had an aunt that come out and she would watch it, but she's terrified. She's like scared of everything. And we had a family graveyard about, I don't know, 75 yards from the house. And her house was a half mile from ours. And you had to walk past that graveyard. So we would watch scary movies. And you know how young we were, 6, 8, 10 years old. We would watch scary movies until 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. And then she didn't drive. So she's like, well, somebody's going to have to take me home. So we would have to walk her home at 8, 9, 10 years old, half a mile at 4 o'clock in the morning. And up in the mountains, there's not really many houses. So we would walk her home and then have to walk all the way back by ourselves.
Yeah, and be pitch dark. And you're talking little kids are walking this adult home after. Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah, but we'd run sometimes. Y'all run like you walk in her home, you're like big brave, you know, and then after she goes in the house, you're like booking it back.
We was like Michael Myers. We was all calm and cool when people was looking at us, but as soon as we was out of sight, we was gone.
I love it.
Booking it. That's so funny.
I love it. I will tell y'all this. Hey, if anybody's looking for a good movie that's in the theaters to watch right now, horror movies, I did drag Lindsay's dad on my birthday. to watch the movie Abigail. Now, I like a good vampire movie. I ain't going to give this one away. This one has a twist, and it's unlike any vampire movie I've ever seen. So it was good. I loved it. I recommend it along with our three movies that we've talked about tonight. Ron, you want to tell people how to get in touch with us on our socials and Gmail?
Yes, absolutely. We are Sirens of the Supernatural on Spotify, on YouTube. We are on Instagram, pretty much all the different social medias, and also on TikTok. We are Supernatural Sirens, and on our email address is sirensofthesupernatural@gmail.com. We would love to hear reader stories, feedback on what you hear on our episodes, what you would like to see on future episodes. If you would like to be a guest, whether you're a podcaster or not, if you have something interesting to tell us. And like I said, we look for realism. We don't want somebody in here just making something up. We want actual experiences because we want to be able to be real and talk to people. We do have a couple of people now reaching out to us that's actually interested from other podcasts and things that other social media outlets. And also, like Rhonda, I watched the new movie, Late Night with the Devil. A little bit different, but I really loved it. I love the way it was set up. I love the plot, how it's set up. Like you said, at the end, there was a very good twist. So I personally recommend it. You know, you're going to get some people that have various opinions. But me personally, I thought it was very well done. And I really enjoyed it. It was a great movie.
Cool. So we've given our viewers a lot to think about, put on their watch list. I'm sure most of our viewers, if they're listening to a paranormal podcast, they like horror movies. So we have enjoyed it, and I'll let you guys go. And as always, and we never get it right, but we always try to say one thing before we leave, and that is stay spooky. Bye, guys.
See ya.